All right, welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, brother. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. And joining us now is Kelsey Atherton. He is the writer on military technology and proprietor of Atherton.kd, Atherton.kd.substack.com. That is Wars of Future Past Substack. Kelsey, thanks so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Kelsey, we do want to get to some more, maybe a substantial, a future of civilization kind of news. Before we get to that, let's get to some your sort of a bread and butter on military technology. There was this crash of a F-35 in, was this Austin? I believe it was.
Oh, I thought it was in Fort Worth, but yeah, I don't know.
Fort Worth. Okay, sorry. And I just wanted your take on the F-35 as, I think people who know about the F-35 are familiar with it as a giant sort of priority of the military industrial complex. Is it a smart one? Is it a valuable one? Or I guess maybe this video can kind of demonstrate, but here's it landing. The first part of this looks pretty cool, I must say. Ejection, and as far as we know, that was nobody died. Kelsey, what's the F-35, and is it like, what is like? I guess for some folks, like, what does Vladimir Putin think when he sees that?
Well, so to start, the F-35 is the one plane in three forms that the military has gone all in on. It's the big new fighter. It's new in the sense that we aren't making others right now. There's not really other fighter jets that newer design since it. There's three versions. The one in the video is the F-35B, which is the one primarily designed for the Marine Corps to replace the Hawker Harrier, which is a jump jet. There's a lot of weird designness going on. The very quick version of this is the military decided they were going to make it. They all wanted a stealth fighter. They wanted to make it three different ways. They wanted a one to replace most of the planes the Air Force flies. That's the F-35A. The Marines wanted one to replace the Harriers that they fly, which means it has to operate from shorter runways on boats that in any other Navy would be aircraft carriers, but we call them amphibious assault ships. We have bigger aircraft carriers than those. That's what the Marines have. The Navy has one called the F-35C. They're all significant. They all have some parts in common, but there's a lot of differences. The B is the most complex. It has one big vent so that its powerful engine, these are also all one engine planes. The Navy typically goes for two engine planes, but decided to go all in on a one engine plane here. And it will redirect the thrust from the jet vertically. So it can, when it works, hover to a takeoff or hover to a landing, which is cool. It's a neat thing to be able to do. It's a technological accomplishment. But also, as we heard, that was the sound of about $104 million crashing to the ground. These are not cheap. That's cheaper than the prices were in the initial batches. It's a very expensive program. The estimate for lifetime cost for the whole F-35 program, which will be 2,400 planes across three different models for the U.S., is something like $1.5 trillion. Big money. Whether or not it scares the leaders of, I don't think anyone looks at the crash and goes, oh no, I'm quaking in my boots. One of the things is that the U.S. somehow has the money and the resources, and certainly the Pentagon has the budget. I wouldn't say it exactly shrugs it off, right? There's going to be big reports. It's a big loss of an equipment. It's important to know why it went wrong and what happened to lead to that crash. We saw the pilot eject at the end, and if they felt they had to eject, was there no way they could stabilize it even when they were virtually on the ground? There's big questions. But it's wild that the U.S. can spend 30 years developing a plane. It can still struggle like this, and the military feels it's basically as competent as it needs to be regardless.
Yeah. Does that signal like a, is that just like, oh, we didn't have our best game today and we've designed a bad plane? Or is that like signal something sort of systemically wrong with even like what the Pentagon and the Defense Department is supposed to be good at?
Right. So one of the sort of big questions when you're designing a high-end stealth fighter as a jump jet is, what war does it need to be all of those things in? Stealth isn't particularly new anymore. The first stealth fighters were initially developed in the 70s and 80s. We have the F-22's been flying for a while. That's an ended production line. And there's other countries that are working on stealth features. But stealth, to invest in stealth, assumes that you are fighting another nation which has radar that is very powerful, and fighter interceptors that are powerful, or missile interceptors that are very powerful. The U.S. hasn't fought a ton of those in a very long time. It's been hard since we can, if the closest thing we've come to fighting a peer air force is probably Korea in the 50s. So we really haven't had to do that since the jet age. But one of the big things is that if you're building a plane for that war, if you're building a fighter jet for that war, how useful is it? And this is the question I always like to append on. How useful is it in the hours before that war turns into a nuclear war? Because at some point, the countries that can field the systems this is designed to defeat are Russia or are China. It's not – Iraq isn't fielding anything, really, wasn't fielding anything that could do this. Iran isn't fielding anything that could particularly stop it. There's some anti-air missiles are getting better. There's some marginal case for it, but there are other ways around that. And we can see that the military knows there's a big limit to putting all of its fighter jet eggs in the F-35-shaped basket, because they're looking at finding ways to kind of put a drone layer between F-35s and enemy systems. There's something they call it the Loyal Wingman program, is the Air Force version. There's a bunch of these where we put drones that are controlled by an F-35 pilot in flight, or at least directed more than like controlled. You're not flying two planes at once, but you're giving commands and it's following. And you'll put more missiles and bombs in those, and you'll put those out first so that the anti-air stuff takes care of that. That's the vision. But it tells you something, that when you get to the point where you're making $100 million fighter jets, that the solution is, oh, we need just several million-dollar drones out in front to catch flak. A lot going on with this plane.
That's very interesting. I hadn't thought about like how it relates to like the drone sort of theory, and the like, what is the use case for these sorts of things, and how soon before it looks like Terminator 2, everybody, and the world's blown away.
Yeah, and it's one of the things where the U.S. likes to, and especially we see this less now that the U.S. is not pretending to be in the war on terror to the same extent. But there was a big point of like, oh, we need to have our military that can fight the highest end war and also counterinsurgency. And we've had like 20 years of fighting counterinsurgency, and it turns out our spare supplies can go and be shipped out to another country to fight a peer-to-peer conflict and work fine. It's unclear what advantage we have given up by investing in this, but it's clearly something, right? The Air Force fluctuates, and the military broadly, between one shared model across forces for jets and then many different models that do more specialized things. It's a whole cyclical process. The last time we had this was like the F-4 Phantom, that was an Air Force and Navy and Marine jet used in Vietnam. But you have to ask, what kind of wars are we spending it on? And is it worth it to be spending this on stealth when there are other ways to meet these needs? And that's even just taking the military's proposition at face value, that there is a meaningful choice here and it's worth spending on in any way, apart from like $100 million in almost everything is a tremendous amount. And then when it's fighter jets, it's not even pocket change for the Pentagon. It's a rounding error of a rounding error.
Right. Well, on that note, and on the note of like nuclear war, let's move to this new discovery of nuclear fusion. Kelsey, give us the good vibes. You know, it's Friday. People want to go into their weekend thinking positively. What's the good vibes sort of top line from this discovery?
So the top line good vibes discovery is that fusion as a source of power that can be controlled by humans on Earth is closer than it ever has been through the second of two ways we know how to generate it that are for pure energy use. Fusion is a hard problem, putting in energy to have more energy come out.
It seems nice.
Sure. Sounds nice. The big highlight from the Department of Energy and from Lawrence Livermore Labs, which did the test, is that it heralds a future of green energy on a renewable basis, on a sort of self-sustaining basis. Fusion is very hard, and they had an experiment. They have this very elaborate facility. I'll get into it in a bit, but where they put a ton of energy through lasers into a specially designed peppercorn-sized target. And in the reaction, 2 megajoules of energy from the laser went in and created, before it fizzled out, over 3 megajoules of energy, which is neat. That's cool. That hasn't happened. That's a genuine accomplishment. And if that could be sustained, replicated, brought down to cost, run on a fuel that can work it, then like other kinds of power, we would have a great new way to boil water efficiently in power turbines, or maybe do something else with it at that point. It could be, but that, the old quip is that fusion is always 50 years in the future, and my most optimistic read on it is now it's maybe 40 years in the future to a sustainable energy from that.
I know. I just wanted to add something here to Matt, because people watch this show know that like I'm a big proponent of civilian nuclear power. And one of the things that's notable here too, and we're going to get to some of the military aspect, but this like big news has already had effects on like that technology. You've seen investment as sort of measured by stock prices of some of the private, nuclear fission companies drop. Because there's a lot of excitement about the possibility of fusion, which you're seeing right now, even though, you know, as you were saying, the joke, it's 50 years in the future. It's always been 50 years in the future. You're seeing right now an immediate effect where money's actually being pulled out from private investors, which, in my opinion, you know, we don't want the whims of different capitalists deciding what kind of energy system we have. But it already is having this kind of effect. So I'm not somebody who wants to knock the exploration of trying to find new technology or things like that. But there has been this pretty early triumphant discourse around it that is already putting the brakes on, you know, programs or systems that we know we can build and work and need a lot more attention and investment. So there's a worrying aspect here too, even apart from the military stuff that I think we'll talk about in a second.
Yeah. So one thing I want to add, right? So the other kind of fusion research, which is, so this fusion one, this ignition fusion happened in a very elaborate facility that's ultimately for testing nukes. We'll get into that in a second. The other kind, you can do it with magnets. You can build gigantic magnetic field fusion generators. There's been a lot of research. They've produced power to some degree, though never any more than the power went in. Sometimes they get close, like the former head of the Department of Energy, one of them is Ernest Moniz, is like super invested into this. There's money exploring it. It has a lot of potential, but we do know, right? Like broadly, if we're looking at ways we know to generate a tremendous amount of energy from nuclear fuel and nuclear science, then fission is what we do. Fission is the classic way fission's been around forever. And that one scales well. It produces waste, which is a a problem of sorts, but you can manage it in various different ways. I mean, there's certainly changing attitudes and better management around it, but that's when we know. We know that works, that technology exists. There were lots of projects that are stood up. There's countries like France that continuously invest in new ones, and then there's ones that get shut down a lot. But that's a technology that's on the shelf, essentially, if we're looking at clean energy. Fusion may get there someday. It didn't get there, though it did prove this was really a like tremendous proof of concept that now we can generate energy in this way. But the facility, this is the National Ignition Facility, is part of Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, and it's been...
And just to jump in, Kelsey, it's ignition not of like your electric vehicle. That's not what is being ignited. Is that correct?
No. This is you put together 192 lasers and you feed them 300 megajoules of energy, and then you get a concentrated 2 megajoules of energy that can ignite a peppercorn of fuel into a 3 megajoule product. That's the math we're talking about. That's like just pulled straight from the Department of Energy press conference. The reason for this facility is partly that it's the scientists believed it have theorized this for a long time, but they figured out about the time, like the idea for this facility and for this kind of fusion came either predates by a year or came the same year as the discovery of how to make lasers happen. It's a long time in the science, but that's the 60s. We're talking about 1960 there. There's another way to create fusion, and that's by a nuclear detonation. This is what separates an atomic bomb, which is a fission detonation, from a H-bomb or a thermonuclear bomb. Those are fusion. You have... And those are set off where they start with a fission reaction. You have one plutonium core that sets it in motion that you blow up. And then the reaction from that detonates a second core, which makes the much more potent, much more powerful one. And that reaction sustains itself. Fission is terrifying because it's a lot of energy released from an atom, and it blows out. But fusion expands and you get a huge yield increase. You go from kilotons to megatons in that. And so the first fusion reactions ever produced by humans were produced in atomic testing is the big, and that's at H-bombs in 1950s technology. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, that, and it's wild. And I think your Twitter feed was the first, I think, to sort of say, like, this is cool, this discovery, but, like, the context for what we're doing here is figuring how we can set off nuclear bombs in the future, and this is sort of a byproduct.
Right, so one of the things that comes up, so the Lawrence Livermore is part of the big National Laboratories complex, and it's all under the Department of Energy, though they date back, you can trace the origins back to the Manhattan Project, and there's intermediate government bodies in between, Atomic Energy Commission, all that. The energy at the heart of this is the destructive energy of nuclear weapons. It's good that the DOE also takes some of its money and puts it into renewables and other energy research. I'm not opposed to that. That's a vital thing for living in a warming world. But it's fundamentally nuclear research. The thing you can do, and you'll hear this phrase, this is sort of the tell phrase. This is when I started getting annoyed at the initial write-ups and eventually pitched an editor to let me to write this. I have a piece up at the Daily Beast.
Yeah, we'll link to that.
Awesome. So the phrase is, it creates the conditions that are hotter than the core of the sun. And that's an interesting way to put things. Fusion does happen in the sun. There's a pretty direct reason you would talk about it that way. But it's also, those are also the conditions created by a nuclear blast. The United States has not detonated a nuclear warhead since 1992. That was the last of the test. The Soviet Union had done a moratorium a little earlier than HW, President HW Bush put in a moratorium. So far, no president has restarted live nuclear testing. We are a generation removed from people who have that firsthand experience. If someone was at the test in 92 and is still working, then they were like an intern at that point or something. It's a real big generation knowledge gap. But the United States maintained the knowledge of how to design and enhance and improve and build nuclear warheads. And it does it through other sciences. The big funding that rolled in for the ignition facility came about because the end of the Cold War meant the end of live testing. Without live testing, you need a way to simulate those conditions to understand things. If you put a ton of lasers and you feed them megajoules of energy into a space and you create that heat and that condition, you're trying to create fusion, you are also creating the conditions inside a nuclear blast. And if you do it in a sphere full of sensors, which is how this is happening, how we're getting the science out of this, then you have a way, without detonating a nuke, to study the conditions of nuclear explosions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've read a few books on like the sort of nuclear close calls. I feel like Dead Hand is one, or Command and Control, and that's not something I'm super thrilled about. And I guess the question is like, and you've written about Alamo Labs, and like looking at how fission sort of came from the Manhattan Project and military purposes. And I think of all of this sort of like 1950s era sort of utopian science communication where it's like, our friend the atom, we're going to have abundant clean energy. And it doesn't quite like turn out like that. And is the military to blame for that sort of thing? Like, is it the way that their advancements get to us, or what should we know about that?
I mean, so one of the things that's wild about the whole development of the sort of the nuclear enterprise, and not just Los Alamos is where they designed the bomb and they assembled the first one and they assembled the first few. They tested it in New Mexico in July 1945. A month later, less than a month, it was like three and a half weeks from the first detonation, it was used on Hiroshima, and then it was used 3 days later on Nagasaki. In that whole process, that was sort of the president signed off on it, and it just kind of happened. They drew up a list of targets. FDR had approval. FDR dies. They run it by Truman. Truman scrawls, makes a little edit on one note, but says, sure, these are the targets you can have. What happens next, right? So the army's just like, okay, great. We have the approval. We have the weapon. We're just going to use it. And then they did another one a few days after. They were supposed to initially be a week spaced apart. They ended up 3 days apart. And when the reports from Nagasaki go in, we get Truman makes the first, what we can, this is our historian Alex Wallerstein's argument, which I find pretty compelling, makes the call to say, okay, we're not doing this ever again without the president saying explicitly that it's time to do this. It started as a weapon that the Army kind of just put into its process. The Army, the Air Force was part of the Army of that in World War II. They're separated in 47. But the Army was just like, we have this new weapon. Obviously, we're using it. We have this war. We're going to use it here on approved targets. And Truman's like, this is killing children. It was explicitly the report that it was killing children from Nagasaki that led to his change in the order. And that sort of, once that happens, right, obviously that's, I mean, it's a tragedy on a scale we haven't experienced. These two bombs that killed, the high estimate is over 200,000. The low estimate is over 100,000. The research that went into all of it is also you, in the process of figuring out how to build the bomb, you figure out how to build nuclear reactors. You figure out that because the plutonium that you want that will be the initial fuel, there's a few ways to get it, but one of the ways is that it's a byproduct of reactor fission. And so you suddenly have this fuel and you have this electrical source, and there's a lot. There was a tremendous amount of science that was done in secret, which also lends it to not being super safe. There's obviously safety things that happen. There's a lot learned. If you ever want to really freak yourself out, read about the Demon Core, which is when they were just like handling a plutonium core with screwdrivers. And then it hit criticality when they put it down wrong, and the scientist who was doing it was dead from radiation poisoning within 24 hours. Just horrific things. And so we get that weapon. We get that weapon. We figure out that weapon. And then we are also ushered into an age of, oh, well, now that the war is over and there won't be wars again, we can go and go forth and in the peace brought about by the nuclear umbrella, we can build all these power plants and reactors. We can figure it out. They've been linked pretty fundamentally. One of the reasons to have nuclear reactors is to develop a weapons program. It's one of the things that comes up a ton, especially when we are following, if you're following like developments of North Korea, it was like they wanted to have reactors. Obviously, there's reasons to have it. It's a very good power source. There's a lot of very straightforward things. But you also, as a side effect, it's hard to build a reactor that doesn't lend itself to also having weapons usable stuff as a byproduct. It's doable. It can be done. There's countries that will lend it out, like France will lend out expertise to try and build it in a way that doesn't. But that's basically where we end up in with this place where it's a tremendously powerful thing that also you can use for the bomb that burns cities.
And maybe this is simplistic, but because there's a lot of thorium boosters out there. But my understanding is we chose uranium for the nuclear weapons capabilities, whereas thorium doesn't have that sort of upside. It's just basically useful for fuel.
Yeah, I would have to, as you might imagine, I know less about the civilian side. The other thing is uranium we had ample quantities of in World War II because we had access, the Allies had access to it through the Belgian Congo. That's its own chapter of horror and exploitation. And then there's also a tremendous uranium reserves in the Colorado Plateau of Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona. So it was also one we had in abundance, in addition to other features of it. And the arsenals it's always worth mentioning, the arsenals are still huge and durable. The arsenals used to be in the tens of thousands of warheads. Right now, counting all warheads that the U.S. has about 5,500, 5,400. Russia has just shy of 6,000. China, which is the third largest, their arsenal is growing, but it's estimated at 350, with the possibility that it could grow to 400 in a few years, and it could reach 1,500 in 15 years, was the Pentagon's latest report. These are real things. These are real parts of how we exist and how we live and shape life. And one of the things, this is actually, so I watched the Department of Energy had a big press conference, and all the news coverage, the initial news coverage of the fusion was very much on the energy front. They were very much like, look at this new breakthrough for future energy. And then you got like through five speakers at the Department of Energy press conference who were talking about deterrence and how we need this for deterrence and we need this for nuclear science. And this, the phrase they use, which is one to just keep an eye out for, is stockpile stewardship, which is essentially the maintenance and evolution of existing nuclear warheads. It signals that we are trying to make sure that all the bombs work as we say they will work. And sometimes it means we take old warheads and we build new bomb casings for them, which is allowed under existing treaties because it doesn't change the number of systems. It just changes the kind or the type of systems. There's a whole bunch of international law and treaties around all of this, but that's what they're explicit, that they're studying this. The main thing you do with this facility, with this fusion, is you study how materials respond to the conditions of a nuclear explosion. Secondarily, you get insight into energy, which could be super useful for the survival of humanity in the future. But that's a ways off. Deterrence and nuclear weapons is the front of this.
I mean, that's what you call a double-sided coin. is there any hope? Like, I mean, yeah, as somebody who focuses on military technology, it seems like that's where most of the money comes from and most of the actual energy is. Like, is there any hope for a world that technology comes from places that aren't designed primarily for warfighting?
I mean, there's all kinds of ways to do and to fund infrastructure. It's been one of the sort of overarching theories, right, is the U.S. figured out how to do macroeconomic stimulus at a level better than anybody during the New Deal, and then they just rolled all that apparatus of state funding right into World War II. And what we've been left with is the notion that the way we fund things is we fund them through the military first, and then there's trickle downs, right? Like you are handoffs or pass where we're doing the internet is a nuclear resilience technology that now has a tremendous commercial rollout from the military. But there's tons of stuff that happens secondarily from that. And it's not, but there's obviously ways you can fund the massive infrastructure other ways. You just have to either in the US, you have to securitize it, or you have to just let the military, you tuck it into a defense omnibus and you say, yeah, sure. What you're really developing is this very cool machine driving technology that we're going to use for like ambulances in the future. And then you have to hope that it actually ends up in ambulances and it isn't guiding robots.
And like the thing is, like as you were just saying, it's like politically in a country where our like political system is pretty much at a standstill, it feels like for most of my life now, it's a lot easier to tack something into the NDAA. Like this is pure warfare stuff, Matt, but I don't know if you were seeing, we were just doing some coverage of Mexico and Tim Kaine attached this whole insane anti-Mexico, anti-AMLO investigation by the U.S. government into his election interference stuff to the NDAA. And again, this isn't technology stuff, but just like there's so much things in that, you know, the budget there that aren't particularly like military or solely have to be like attached to the military that are, because it's just something you can sneak that in because it's an automatic yes vote for most folks.
The CHIPS Act is also the other sort of direct example of it, which is designed to restart and increase U.S. semiconductor production, which has been like, I was covering an earlier version of it a couple of years ago for Breaking Defense, and you get like John Cornyn of Texas, not a liberal light or a big government proponent. Anyway, he's like, well, we just got to do it for national security. I'm not a big fan of like industrial policy, but we have to for this reason. And so we're getting big microchip funding, which like it's nice to see the government investing in the economy in a way, even if the like it's subtext is it's not even subtext. It's the text of it is we need to do this because what if there's a shooting war in the Pacific and we don't have access to China's factories and we might not have access to Taiwan or South Korean factories. That's right. The reason for it. Mm-hmm. And what we're getting out of it is like microchip plants in Arizona and Ohio. Okay. Industrial policy happens in many ways. It's very weird that to do it in the US, you have to point to a war that drives it, but that's kind of where we're at. And so, but I think we have to be, and this is sort of the reason I wrote about it and the reason I like got so mad about it online as one does, is we have to talk about the military thing as the driver of this. Mm-hmm. Lawrence Livermore did not develop fusion research for the benevolence of its own thing. It does it because it's a weapons-related program that you can do other science with. There are pure science programs. There are very cool pure science programs that exist. The national labs are complex and house many things. They find other tasks they do, but when there's a weapons tie, it's very important to foreground that to explain, oh, this happened because the cool science effect is secondary to the war purposes.
Absolutely. Well, Kelsey Atherton, I'll share, it's Wars of Future Past, athertonkd.substack.com and athertonkd on Twitter. Kelsey, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great talking to you.
Absolutely.